Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Today on the program, how oil and gas permitting continued to occur on public lands while the shutdown was in full swing.
It doesn't make any sense at all to folks outside the government that are looking at this.
Agencies that distribute food and food stamps say all the uncertainty about the government shutdown could mean people will get lost in the system.
To make sure people don't starve, don't freeze to death, have a place to live, have their medical bills paid.
The 2018 Farm Bill legalized hemp and CBD. Wyoming hasn't followed suit. Will the legislature change that?
We'll also hear about the efforts of lawmakers to improve Wyoming elections and an interview with the publisher of Native American comic books, right here on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Air traffic controllers are working without pay, food and drug inspections are falling behind, and Native American communities are missing out on federal funding. A restart on all that is unclear in the temporary government reopening. Meanwhile, an industry close to President Trump's heart has gone largely unaffected. Some Department of Interior employees who handle drilling permits are working and getting paid. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
In an hour-long hearing, frustrated Democrats on the House Natural Resources Committee called out the Trump administration for blatant favoritism toward the oil and gas industry.
Welcome. First, I'd like to...
California Congressman Alan Lowenthal complained that oil and gas has gone unscathed while all walks of life are feeling the pain.
It is utterly immoral that the Trump administration treats one group of friendly businesses, the fossil fuel industry, as more valuable and deserving than all others.
The hearing pondered legality, impacts to public lands without public input, and whether the Interior Department has become a favor factory for special interests. Committee Chairman Raul Grijalva says there will be litigation over this.
Somebody has to answer as to how you went about prioritizing what you did, and health and safety of the public became secondary. Protection of our public assets became secondary.
Kelly Fuller agrees. She's with the Western Watersheds Project, a conservation nonprofit.
It doesn't make any sense at all to folks outside the government that are looking at this.
Fuller says past shutdowns have not done this. During the 2013 shutdown over Obamacare, the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, wasn't able to process about 200 applications for permits to drill.
Clearly, it wasn't truly essential. This is just a made-up excuse right now to serve the oil and gas industry.
The BLM is not doing environmental reviews. And Fuller is concerned that leasing on public lands might go ahead without specialized analysis for wildlife or archaeology. Even so, she says the BLM is accepting more and more permits to begin drilling. That number is now well over 200. Fuller says that's unacceptable.
Because one of the problems that's happening right now is with this oil and gas permit processing during the shutdown, the oil and gas industry is not shut out, but the public is.
There have been no press briefings. Public comment web pages have gone dark. If you call or email the BLM, the response will likely be radio silence.
This is your Casper BLM.
Or it'll be a stock recording.
Due to a lapse in funding of the federal government budget, we are out of
Phil Flynn acknowledges communication may not be as simple as normal, but the BLM is still partially open. He's an oil and gas analyst with the Price Futures Group. He understands why the Trump administration considers oil and gas permitting vital. He says the first reason is economics.
It's a big part of the gross domestic product. If the industry slowed down, it would slow down the economy.
And it's a part of the economy the Trump administration has been working to increase under the president's energy dominance philosophy. The Interior Department has boasted huge gains in oil production, and upcoming lease sales in February and March are offering unprecedented levels of new acreage, much of that coming from public land in western states like Wyoming. But Flynn says energy dominance isn't just a phrase. It's about national security.
I think there's a belief in the Trump administration that being one of the world's biggest oil producers gives us more security from countries that in the past tried to use oil as a weapon against our economy.
But is paying federal workers to process drilling permits allowed in a shutdown? Christopher McKnight-Nichols is a historian at Oregon State University. He says the federal guidelines are vague. and shutdown decisions can fall prey to politics.
They're allowed to keep things going that are deemed necessary. And this is the interesting question about oil and gas, for instance. Why is there continuing permitting for drilling? That does not seem necessary, but the administration can make a case that it is and therefore keep things going.
Nichols says it's not unusual to see this level of politics thrust into shutdown decisions. But he says it is surprising to see so many other federal programs falter while oil and gas chugs along. In an email, a Bureau of Land Management representative says the agency is not prioritizing permit processing over its other work, and that its actions are consistent with the agency's contingency plan for the shutdown. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
As lawmakers will now try and reach a compromise with the short-term lifting of the government shutdown, Wyoming lawmakers are holding firm with President Trump's demand for a wall. Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
President Trump turned heads for different reasons on Saturday when he put those DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival Kids, on the table as a potential way to end this partial government shutdown. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney says it showed Trump is serious.
I think it shows that he's willing to, do something reasonable and try to come to an agreement. And in this situation, if you look all across the country, that's what people want. I think they look at Washington right now and, they want to know that people are working to be reasonable, come to a compromise.
Cheney also predicts Trump's offer will eventually move Democrats, like Speaker Nancy Pelosi, closer to the GOP's position that a wall is essential.
Yeah, I think she's particularly got members who are vulnerable, who are in swing districts, and they've got people at home who are saying, what in the world, you won't secure the border. It's going to be tough. It's going to get increasingly tough for her to hold her caucus together on this.
But most Democrats say the pain being felt from the closure of 25% of the federal government is too much pain for many to endure, especially those in Indian country. New Mexico Democratic Congresswoman Deb Haaland is one of the two newly seated Native American women in Congress.
Indian country's been hit hard before the government shut down, so yeah, this doesn't help, obviously.
Haaland says most Democrats support efforts to put new security measures along the border, but that they don't want to support a wall that many experts say is unnecessary.
I think there's a lot of solutions to border security. But we shouldn't hold the American people hostage. I mean, there's millions of people who are affected by the shutdown. The government needs to open, and we're willing to talk.
But Wyoming Senator John Barrasso says when he was recently back in Wyoming, that's not the message he heard. When specifically asked about this historic closure of the national parks and the broader Interior Department, he said he hasn't heard a complaint about it.
One person after another after the next said, build the wall. Stand with the president. Make sure we have border security. Border security is national security.
But Montana Democrat John Tester questions Barrasso's account.
I think that's a false narrative. I'll just tell you that. I don't believe that's true at all.
Tester says his voters want the government fully functioning, their federal parks open, and more border security.
They want to see the parks opened up. They want to see the federal workers put back to work. And they want to see us negotiate on a good southern border security policy and a good northern border security policy.
But right now, Washington is just filled with bad blood. So Republican leaders like Barrasso and Cheney remain skeptical that Democrats like Speaker Nancy Pelosi are negotiating in good faith.
Well, the problem is that, the president asked her directly, if I open up the government, then will you, come to the table on a wall? And she said, absolutely not. So this is all, playing games and wasting time. The president is not going to sign any of the bills that they're putting on the floor.
Well, Cheney says she's still with the president, who has still refused to sign any bill to get even part of the government open unless he gets wall funding. She says she hates the shutdown.
At the same time, people are working without pay, and that is just, Wyoming obviously has got a lot of federal employees, and it's a situation we've got to be working to solve. We should never have, people being asked to do things and they're not getting paid for it.
So for now, and into the foreseeable future, the shutdown and this high-stakes game of political chicken still continue to grip the nation. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we come back, a regional story on the census and a discussion about grizzlies. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. The battle over a controversial citizenship question on the 2020 census may have profound economic implications for our region. Ali Budner reports.
Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross added the question last year. It asks, is this person a citizen of the United States? If yes, you record when and how you became a citizen. If no, you check the box, no, not a U.S. citizen. Elizabeth Garner is the state demographer for Colorado. She says even though everyone is legally required to fill out the census,
a lot of concerns are that people are just going to refuse to fill out the questionnaire.
Out of fear, confusion, or even out of protest.
And that then can lead to severe undercounts of the total population.
Soon after the question was added, a number of cities and states filed a lawsuit to get it removed. A federal court ruled in their favor. The Trump administration appealed and has asked the U.S. Supreme Court to expedite a hearing. Garner says high stakes are pinned to the outcome.
We miss out a lot when we don't have full information about our population.
A quick civics review here. For nearly 2.5 centuries, every household in the country has been asked to fill out the census form. It comes every 10 years. You're asked about your age, sex, and race, how many people are living in the household, the relationships between them. You get the idea. It's the government trying to figure out how many people and what kinds of people live where. Garner says that information plays an important role in our democracy.
It is the foundation for representative government. So you know how we have the House of Representatives and there's representatives based on the population of every state? This is the foundation for it. It's awesome.
But Garner says it's important to remember census data also determines the amount of money each state gets from the federal government. And that's where our region could lose big.
Federal funding is allocated based on population.
In the Mountain West, it ranges from about $1,000 to $2,000 per person. Garner says that money directly goes to fund programs like Medicare and Medicaid, food stamps, road improvement, and public housing. And that data is used for 10 whole years.
So if by chance we're undercounted in that decennial count, then that undercount impacts our federal funding allocation throughout the decade.
And if enough immigrants don't fill in the survey, that's a problem, especially for our region, where we've been outpacing the national average for growth in our immigrant populations. Lawrence Benenson is with the National Immigration Forum in Washington, D.C., a nonprofit think tank.
What I think has been overlooked by a lot of people is given the changing immigration patterns we've had in the United States over the past 10, 20 years, a number of red states would be negatively impacted.
That includes states in our region. Hans von Spakovsky is with the Heritage Foundation. He shrugs off the claim that the question could cause an undercount of the population.
There's absolutely no evidence to support that. That's pure speculation. If you are a non-citizen in the country legally, then there's no reason for you not to fill out the survey.
And he believes the citizenship question is especially important right now.
Because we are in the midst of a very vigorous debate about immigration policy, and it's hard to do that without accurate information and data.
It's a debate this group of students are very familiar with. They're mostly immigrants from Mexico, and this is an English as a second language class in Colorado Springs. Some here say they'll fill out the survey no problem. Others say they won't, or at least they'll leave the citizenship question blank. But Victoria Soto voiced a universal concern.
The problem is no you are or no are citizen. The problem is what the government doing with this information.
Soto's question on what the government will do with the information has a real root in history. During World War II, census information helped the U.S. government locate Japanese American citizens to be rounded up for internment camps. Still, Colorado State demographer Elizabeth Garner says it's important to note that since the 50s, we've had strong privacy laws to keep individual-level data confidential. She also responds to another concern.
The citizenship question doesn't get to legal status either. So you're not putting out there that you're an illegal resident.
Whether that will put minds at ease remains to be seen. And whether the citizenship question gets the green light or not, the issue has to be decided by June. That's when the survey goes to the printer. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ali Budner.
Thank you.
Changing gears, Doug Peacock spent much of his life alone in the wilderness in Montana and Wyoming observing grizzly bears. Director Ben Moon just released a short film titled Grizzly Country, focusing on Peacock's life and connection to grizzlies. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska spoke with Doug Peacock about how grizzly bears helped him after returning from Vietnam and why he believes they need to continue to be protected.
The one place I've always been comfortable is the wilderness, you know, the wilderness, especially in the American West. And so, you know, I went up into the mountains where I ran into grizzlies. I wasn't looking for them, but they were there, and they certainly get your attention. And it just turned out that was the one thing I needed above all things, was something bigger than myself, where self-indulgence is really impossible in grizzly country because you got something out there that can kill and eat you anytime it wants to, even though it tends not to. And you know, you have to take stock of the grizzly. And that precludes a lot of shallow, intrusive thought. It's really an enforced humility. And it was just what I needed. They command your attention, you know. You can't walk down the trail thinking about your portfolio or your girlfriend or anything like that. You know, your senses are all tuned into, you know, something potentially dangerous. It's certainly dominant. I mean, a grizzly bear just covers a complexion of an entire place. You know, it's the one animal in North America that challenges the most arrogant being on Earth, which is Homo sapien, for its position in the world. You know, we're not top dog. We're not the top of the pyramid.
The film Grizzly Country, why was that something that you wanted to do?
My daughter's friend set it up. And when I saw the finished product, I was stunned. It's so beautiful. It takes my breath away.
How do you feel about the politics of grizzly bears today?
The same federal agency delisted the grizz back in 2007. We went to court and got them back on the list. They did it. And, you know, they announced that on the 3rd of March, 2016. I immediately wrote a letter to Obama that was, you know, signed by all my well-known friends. 14 of us signed that letter, and that was the beginning of this campaign that ended up, it now has a name. It's Save the Yellowstone Grizzly. They wanted to produce a film that we would, as a tool, that we would subsequently take on the road, and I'd ask people like Jeff Bridges to go with me, and we'd contact, you know, as much of, especially the rural population of Montana, that we could.
And you are hoping that the film will make people more aware of this issue?
Yeah, and, you know, I don't see it as a thing unto itself. I see it as a tool. You know, I would carry it around and show it to as many people as possible. You know, I have made films in my past, but I'm not a filmmaker and really don't care about that kind of stuff much anymore. But it's a tool. And I'd go around with, you know, some of my close friends, and we just have a dog and pony show. But, you know, we'd show this film and then engage with questions and comments. You know, we'd listen and we'd give our side of it, too. Grizzly bears are not the only thing threatened with near extinction by climate change. We're in exactly the same dinghy, you know. We're, you know, where the bear goes, we're going to be right with him. And, you know, I take this whole thing really serious because not just in my bears, but, you know, my first grandchild was born in October. I got lots of reasons, and I plan on fighting for the rest of my life. You know, it may be grizzlies, but really we're fighting for all of us.
So do grizzlies kind of exemplify the wilderness of the earth?
Yeah, they do, and they're so human-like in so many ways. Their habitats, you know, their physical appearance, you know, where they live and what they eat. It's the same as humans. You know, they're great omnivores. And ever since humans have come to North America, they've followed the footprints of grizzly bears for 20,000 years. That gives me immense kinship, you know.
That That was Doug Peacock, who's featured in a new short film called Grizzly Country, speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska.
When we come back, we'll have three stories from the legislative session. This is Open Spaces.
You're listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. From time to time, people want to do something about Wyoming's primary election. Some hate the time of year, some hate that Democrats have no say, and some don't like that Democrats can cross party lines and have too much of a say. This year is one of those times. If it will lead to anything is anyone's guess, but what's clear is that there's no consensus on what should be done and if the state can afford it. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck explains.
This week, the Legislature's Senate Corporations and Elections Committee entertained a couple of bills that would change how people vote in the primary. One was a Republican Party-driven bill that would keep people from changing parties after a specific date. It was crafted in response to last year's Republican gubernatorial primary, where some think Democrats helped determine the outcome by crossing over and voting in the Republican primary. Committee Chairman Bill Landon of Casper was not convinced that something needs to be done.
I'm not really aware of any election that was tainted that much by that. It has not been decided by crossover, let's put it that way. And so, I've got to be convinced that that government wants to ride in and lock things down.
However, another issue did get the attention of lawmakers, and that's the fact you can win a primary with a limited amount of support. Senator Cale Case notes that many times Republicans run a number of candidates for a seat.
I also ran in a crowded primary once in a statewide race, and it is pretty frustrating because you get these narrow slivers of votes. Doesn't seem like that is the best way to move forward the person with them that has the best chance of leading Wyoming.
Laramie Senator Chris Rothfuss explains it this way.
80% of the people could think you were the worst candidate on the ballot, but you got 20 points and others only got 15, so you move on to the general.
Rothfuss proposed an idea that the committee supported. Wyoming would have a primary where everyone could vote, no matter their political affiliation. Voters would select a first and second choice and possibly more, and after it was sorted out, you would have the top two candidates.
Those two would then have the opportunity to have a very competitive general election from that point forward.
That could be two Republicans going head-to-head. The bill was approved by the committee but soundly thrashed on the Senate floor. Part of the concern is that Wyoming would have to buy a lot of new equipment to make this work, which would be expensive. Senator Case, though, thinks the idea is worth studying further, but so is another idea. Putting the primary in the spring, and if someone doesn't have a decisive victory, there would be a runoff election.
And that would be an exclusively a party election. I think our county clerks and the would not be in favor of that because of the workload, but it would give us better results.
But that also would mean that counties would have to have a second election, which Senator Landon points out costs money.
You're always concerned about the cost of elections, and it's too bad that we have to worry about that, but you do have to balance what you spend with all the revenues that you don't have.
But Landon admits that an August primary is also not ideal, and an earlier primary would probably bring about a higher turnout. While that might be true, Marguerite Herman of the League of Women Voters says the way it's currently done is still compelling and interesting.
You know, the fact that they have many, many candidates running does make it makes it contentious. You would think they'd be happy to have such interest in winning their party's nomination. I'd view that as a feather in my cap.
Secretary of State Ed Buchanan wants to improve elections, including ways to get rid of dark money where unknown groups are attacking a particular candidate. He's not sure what the actual solution here is, but he welcomes a legislative study.
Oh, I would absolutely revel in that. You know, I'm a political science guy from way back when, and I find it fascinating the way different states conduct their elections. And so I absolutely would love to participate in a study on this and look at a way that everybody, you know, could be happy.
But whether or not that would actually happen remains to be seen. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
For years, Wyoming lawmakers have been grappling with how to ensure kids are safe at school. In 2009, they passed anti-bullying legislation. Last year, they granted districts the right to decide whether to arm teachers and staff as a defense against violent intruders. This session, school violence is once again on the docket. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson sat down with Cheyenne Senator Affie Ellis to discuss her support for a bill that would require all districts to develop comprehensive school safety and security plans.
As a mom, I've got three kids who are in public school in Cheyenne, and since the first time I dropped my oldest kid off at kindergarten, I've seen the investments that my school district has made to improve security measures. And as I've traveled the state visiting with family and friends, there is inconsistency in what safety measures are being implemented. And so on the floor, I did mention one instance where I was needing to use the restroom. The only place I could seem to find was a school. And I thought my experience would be, you know, a difficult one getting in, and it wasn't. I walked right in and was, you know, just motioned to go down the hallway. And it was really a frightening moment, just thinking about the lack of security measures in that one particular building. So really the intent of the bill is to create a base level of security measures that we can tell any parent across the state that we've looked at this issue, that we're requiring districts to have some pretty comprehensive safety plans.
And so in terms of trying to create consistency across the state, what are the teeth that this bill has to ensure that would happen?
Well, we've worked a lot with the Department of Homeland Security, and a number of years ago, they developed a comprehensive report working with others in the school districts with our state superintendent's office, and they developed a 300-page plan, and I believe it was sent to every school district. And so depending on who you talk to, some of the people have looked at that plan, others have it sitting on a shelf. So really, we tried to pull out a few of the best practices identified in some of those plans. We worked a lot talking with Homeland Security. And by and large, one really important way that we can address safety is by giving kids some training. And so really, that's what the intent of the bill is to do, is to give teachers, staff, and students some options so that if a violent intruder were to enter their school, they wouldn't just automatically default to a lockdown mentality. And as I've done this training myself, it's important to give people the permission and experience to practice what it means to evacuate, to barricade certain doors, and to really start thinking about what they would do if an active shooter were penetrating their school. It's absolutely an unpleasant thing, but I think it's what we should be thinking about and trying to prepare for and plan against. And so really, that's the intent of the bill.
And I heard some caution about legislating safety and security when this should be an issue that school districts should handle on their own.
You know, right now school districts have to have some safety plans, but we're really trying to look at what's in those plans. And as I mentioned, there's been a lot of great information that's developed over the decades about what an appropriate response is. Unfortunately, I think we've seen some districts who think that lockdown is the only appropriate response. And so the bill that passed out of the Senate really has a handful of prescriptive measures that are best practices. And you know, being on the Senate Education Committee, I'm always mindful of trying to strike that right balance of not infringing too much on local control. And so I think this bill really gives districts the ability to write their own plans, to accommodate their own local needs. But the reality is, you know, I remember the Columbine shooting and the number of shootings that continue to happen. We can't wait for districts to maybe or maybe not take action. And so this bill really prompts districts to start doing that.
I was struck by the fact that in the bill, where you're starting to get into the details about safety and security plans, that interventions and mental health was at the top of the list. And I'm wondering, did you place it at the top of the list on purpose?
I think that prevention, you know, we had some discussion about it in the interim of how do you mandate to school districts that they prevent any kind of awful situation from happening, and that's a fair question. But there are some techniques, and there's been a lot of research and work done on how to identify some of these troubled students. And again, in taking some of these training courses myself, there are signs that students exhibit, but you know, we don't necessarily live in a culture that encourages students to be tattletales or tell on, you know, their classmates. And in thinking about, you know, a recent incident in Wyoming, that was a game changer, was one student speaking up. And so I think these trainings that students will be exposed to really kind of start shifting that mentality that you're not, you know, tattling on someone, that you're actually, it's a responsibility and an important thing to speak up if you see another classmate exhibiting some dangerous signs. And certainly we want to make sure that teachers have that training as well. So I know there's concern about that language, but I think that's critical for preventing those kind of incidents from happening.
And then beyond creating and submitting the plan, is there anything in this bill that holds districts to account when it comes to actually following through on what they've said they're going to do?
You know, my hope would be that it sparks a good conversation, not only among district administrators and school board members, but really community and parents and students. And, you know, again, as someone who has children in public school, I think that people have wonderful ideas. And so that these plan, the development of these plans is a wonderful way to incorporate some of those talented resources we have in our communities with our parents, with our students. And so I understand concerns about the bill, but on the flip side of it, I think it provides a tremendous opportunity for people to be really engaged in talking about what's right for kids. So hopefully this is a first step in giving parents assurances that the safety and security needs of their students are being met.
Senator Ellis, thank you for your time.
Thank you for your interest in this issue. It's important.
Senate File 64 on school safety and security passed out of the Senate this week and is now being considered by the House.
Cannabidiol, or more commonly known as CBD, has gained popularity as people use those products for anxiety, back pain, and even epilepsy. As Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska reports, CBD is currently illegal in Wyoming, but a bill on industrial hemp might resolve the problem.
Kelly Lostreder is the manager of Smoker Friendly in Cody. She carried a number of CBD products in her store, but at the end of August, she was informed that she had to pull those items off of her shelves.
State of Wyoming was not allowing it, even though it had just been approved for all 50 states. Wyoming said no, and that was that.
Smoker Friendly is a chain of over 800 retail stores. According to a site manager at the corporation, Wyoming law enforcement tested some CBD products and said any trace of THC, which is the main psychoactive ingredient in marijuana, was illegal. So they pulled all CBD products from their store locations in Wyoming. Lostreder says that's not right.
You know, I like to carry what's popular and what works for them and what sells well, and it's not, shouldn't be illegal.
Under the 2018 Farm Bill guidelines, hemp is no longer considered an illegal substance, but rather a crop. CBD is extracted from hemp, and the law reads, any CBD product with less than 0.3% of THC is legal. But as attorney and state lawmaker Charles Pelkey says, there have been felony arrests for possession of CBD.
There were at least three, if not four, arrests in the state for people with possession of CBD oil, which has less than 0.3% THC, and they were arrested for possession of marijuana in liquid form.
Representative Pelkey sponsored a House bill that would have decriminalized CBD, but it was defeated in the House Judiciary Committee. Yet another bill is pushing through the Wyoming legislature, known as the Hemp Opportunity Act. Christine Bex is the executive director for the Powell Economic Partnership.
They're operating in a market that's specialty and niche. And that's an area where I really think that Wyoming can excel.
The bill would support hemp as an agricultural crop in the state. Bex says This would give Wyoming farmers more diversification, which is key to growing the economy.
An alternative crop for our growers and can provide a diversification in their rotation and then also revenue streams. And some of the numbers around industrial hemp are pretty tremendous.
According to a recent analysis by a business consulting firm, the global market for industrial hemp was $3.9 billion in 2017 and is projected to grow to $10.6 billion by 2025. Bex wants Wyoming to be a leading producer, but she says there is some concern about how byproducts will be regulated of having less than 0.3% THC levels.
And that's the distinctive factor between hemp and marijuana, which of course is federally illegal and also illegal in Wyoming. So while hemp is a commodity crop, it does bring with it some concerns that, for example, soybeans don't have.
Representative Pelkey says he currently doesn't have any plan to try to use the industrial hemp bill as a way to legalize the use of CBD. Cheyenne resident Nina Herbert relies on CBD oil and patches to stop her seizures from epilepsy, and she says opponents don't see CBD's medical benefits.
It's also just really rooted in old ideas about what people who use marijuana in general look like, without really giving thought to the fact that CBD isn't something that will even make you high.
Whether Wyoming will take the chance to become a game changer in the hemp industry or stays stuck in old ideas is anyone's guess, as the bill waits to be heard on the House floor. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
When we come back, we'll take a look at how Wyoming has been trying to get people their SNAP benefits with the uncertainty surrounding the federal government. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. The Wyoming Department of Family Services has been working overtime to issue Wyoming families their food benefits, known as SNAP, a couple of weeks early. As Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, that's because with the government reopening for only just 3 weeks, it's unclear whether they'll get them again.
Corin Schmidt is Wyoming's Department of Family Services interim administrator. She says, sure, families have their food benefits for this month, but with negotiations tense over when the government will be reopened to stay, DFS has a whole new challenge, making sure people don't fall out of the system indefinitely.
We're concerned about our families. We're concerned about the long-term consequences. But we're also focusing on what we need to do to get fully operational when the funding is released.
Almost 14,000 households in Wyoming depend on SNAP to feed them each month. And most of those are single moms with children.
I mean, children need to have food. They need to have calories and appropriate calories, so that their brain development continues, so that they have the ability to continue to learn. Certainly school performance can be affected as well if you have a child that's hungry.
Schmidt says DFS is trying to do small things to help people, like not forcing federal employees to pay their child support this month. But she says it's hard for a big state agency like hers to shut down and then restart without affecting the dependability of their services. But she says if food benefits continue to stop and start,
I think one of the best pieces of advice I could give families is to not be shy and reach out to their community organizations. Communities do a wonderful job of pulling together resources. You know, they're much more agile than we are as a state government to meet needs.
This is our food pantry.
One community organization bracing itself in case of gaps in SNAP benefits is Interfaith Good Samaritan in Laramie. Head volunteer Julie is filling a bag of food for client David Russell, who says he's living on disability checks. Wyomingites on disability use SNAP at some of the highest rates.
What are you getting for your bag here?
Cereal, tuna,
fruit cocktail,
crackers.
And apples. A truck full of fruit crashed on the interstate, and so today, volunteers are furiously sorting it, weighing it, and stuffing it into everyone's arms. Mike Verkotteren is Interfaith's director. He says his agency takes advantage of any opportunity to supply the 900 pounds of food they give away every single day here. Albany County is one of the poorest counties and has the highest rates of food insecurity in Wyoming. He says people who come through his door often can't find jobs, but many more do, and they still struggle.
Working hard and not earning enough money to pull it all together. Honestly, that's traumatic.
Verkotteren says there are lots of Forest Service and TSA employees in town, and many college students who rely on federal loans they might not get. He says those folks have started stopping by to ask questions.
Like, well, I don't know what's going to happen, and if I do not get my next check, things are getting grim, what can you help me with?
Verkotteren says he's especially worried about whether his agency can handle more suffering in a community where 26% of people already live below the poverty line.
If it does continue and people are going to be in trouble with their house payment and their car payment or their rent payment, we do want to help, but the financial resources to offer that, it's going to be tough. I don't know what kind of agencies, all the government agencies are shut down, right? So we can't go to our typical, grantors and ask for funds. So it's got to come from the community.
Luckily, Interfaith Good Samaritan isn't shouldering this crisis alone. Just upstairs is United Way, another nonprofit that finds funds for programs like Interfaith. Director Paul Heimer says he just got approval from his board to offer federal employees short-term loans they can repay when the government opens and stays open.
To make sure people don't starve, don't freeze to death, have a place to live, have their medical bills paid. We hear reports of people who are only, using half their medications because they don't have money. They're, suffering from diabetes. They're not taking their insulin, all that sort of stuff. We will prevent that from happening here in Albany County, I guarantee you.
When asked what advice Heimer gives to families facing a gap in SNAP benefits, he says, come to Interfaith. And don't be afraid to ask for help. But he also has some other advice.
Contact our congressional delegation and tell them to do their damn jobs and get this government open again. And I mean that.
Wyoming's U.S. Senator Mike Enzi is currently working on efforts to prevent future shutdowns. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
This month, the Laramie County Library in Cheyenne hosted a series of events by Indigenous artists and speakers to explore Native people's concepts of illness and health. One speaker was Laguna Pueblo tribal member Lee Francis, who owns Red Planet Books and Comics in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Lee is also the CEO of the printing press Native Realities. His talk was about Native representation in pop culture. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner met with Francis at a local watering hole in downtown Cheyenne to talk about the importance of seeing yourself reflected in the media you consume.
What's your favorite Native superhero?
I won't pick among my children that we publish, although I love them all. I have all my favorites. Aragon Starr's Super Indian is fantastic. It's the longest running Native comic book or Native comic series. She draws a new 3-panel set every Monday. You know, she's moving on to the third volume around Super Indian. It's funny, it's relevant, it works within Native communities. You know, the things we produce or have produced, Tribal Force, The Wool of Jonesy, you know, these are all great. You know, both superheroes and just heroes. Tales of the Mighty Code Talkers, so the Code Talkers are some of my favorite Native superheroes. I've always said the Code Talkers are superheroes. They had they have a special power, their language, that they have to keep hidden from the world because the world doesn't want them to use that, that they use to save the world, right? So, you know, I would say, you know, in that sense, superheroes, living superheroes are these Code Talkers. You know, there's many more, I think, that are out there that I'm still discovering. So, you know, those are some of my favorites.
What are some of the negative effects of not seeing yourself in the media you consume?
I think the main effect is that it leaves you sort of grasping at whatever's out there. And so when you don't see yourself in any, you know, in any way that you identify yourself. So for me as a Native person, when I don't see myself represented positively in popular media, then I'm going to grasp at whatever. And if it's a negative representation or a negative connotation or is, you know, rife with problems, I'm going to gravitate towards that anyway. It's why we have a lot of the issues with, say, mascots, because we know, studies have shown, a lot of this stuff is very detrimental to Native youth, et cetera, et cetera. But it's the only image that's out there that we can identify with. You know, I love to see Native heroes. I love to see, for the young people I've taught throughout my life, I want them to have heroes. I want them to have heroes that look like them so that there's at least one that they can look towards and say, yeah, that one looks like me. I had that one growing up, and that was really awesome. I think it's important to recognize that that's one of the benefits of being able to use a medium like comic books, is that we're able to explore the visuals and wed them to the story itself. And so the storytelling becomes very important. Those visuals help create that overlay and create a different dynamic of how Native people are represented in popular media. And, you know, these images in theater and then film and television and then et cetera, as we express the Native identity through someone else's lens through popular media, we can take things like comic books and games and animation, et cetera, and change those visuals.
Yeah, I was going to ask you a little bit about where is that line of being negatively culturally appropriative and then a cultural exchange of, like, being able to represent Native Americans and more than just in a headdress or something like that.
I think it's the core of the company name itself. It's Native Realities. And so it's really understanding anybody that chooses to represent Native people. Are you representing it because it looks cool? Or are you representing it because, are you choosing those representations? Are you choosing to portray Native people in a certain way because you're wanting the food, feathers, and fun? For us, we try to dig deeper, and we want people to also dig deeper in the work that they're doing, to go out and talk with Native folks, to be historically accurate and representational, to understand that headdresses weigh a lot, so I'm not going to wear them all the time. I don't go out and walk out in a tux every day. There are people that do, but the imagination and the cultural consciousness of Native and Indigenous people is that is the daily existence. And that's incorrect. And that's incorrect historically, but also incorrect in terms of the ways in which we represent ourselves today.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner speaking with Laguna Pueblo tribal member Lee Francis, who's the owner of Red Planet Books and Comics in Albuquerque and the CEO of the printing press Native Realities.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the program or want to hear an individual segment, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Anna Rader is our web editor, and don't forget, you can sign up for our podcast and never miss a program.
Bringing you this high-quality coverage every week costs money. If you'd like to support this show or our Wyoming news effort, you can do so at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on the Pledge Now button. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.